Hi and hello, Santa Fe University of Art and Design, or other listeners. This is the Squadcast. Here I'm Nick Martinez.
And I'm Chris Stalen.
And today we talk to Hideki Nakazono, writer of Seven Falls and a teacher here at Santa Fe University of Art and Design. And I have to say, overall, I really liked his book.
It was a fantastic interview to sit on, and Hideki was very open with his inner thoughts, and
I thought he was pretty honest.
Yeah. It was a nice interview. I've never sat down with an author before, so
yeah,
it was a pleasure to sit in.
Yeah, we really didn't go over it too much in the interview, so right now I'll just do a brief plot synopsis. Basically, it's just about a young man who's dealing with the death of his older brother, his star older brother, who he always kind of lived in the shadows. And basically, it's kind of part a coming-of-age story and part a dealing-with-grief story. And I think the two sort of stock plots really came together, and I really think he built a nice narrative throughout. I wouldn't say that the book was perfect. I think they were. I think he could have mixed up his sentences more. Yeah, just in general, I think it could have been shorter. But I mean, overall, I think I think the characters were well done. I thought the dialogue was great, and I think the sum of all of his parts made it worth it. I think the book was good enough for you to ignore some of the parts that weren't working as strongly as others.
And I have little to no opinion of it so far, solely because I've yet to read the
book. Yeah, Chris hasn't read it yet. But Chris will read the book.
I will read the book. So yes, here's the interview. Enjoy.
Just have a series of questions here. First off, I just want to start off and say I enjoyed the book.
Great.
I did.
Thank you.
Just to start off, with such weighty subjects throughout the book, where'd you get the inspiration for Seven Falls?
Well, there are some pretty deep themes there. I had known for a long time that I wanted to write a book, and I started becoming introspective about many of the ideas in high school when a friend of mine was facing prison time for a series of, you know, poor choices, I guess we'll say. And it sort of affected me at that time, and I realized that these poor decisions that people can make have long-lasting effects. And it was at that point that I started writing, and I knew that I wanted to pursue something in sort of a long form to kind of look at the way people develop ideas and the way that they live out their lives based on those ideas. And so that was kind of the motivation for how the whole thing came up. The allusion to a lot of the cultural, a lot of the, I guess what you'd call the religious moments in the book, occurred in part because my grandfather, he wrote a book himself called The Kodotama Principle, which had to do with this idea that humanity moves in civilizations, and we are on the verge or have just entered into what he described as the third civilization. The first civilization was one that was largely led by faith. Some people might call it magic. Religion is another way to look at it. And he believed that, according to the Kodotama Principle, the argument was that the second civilization based our ideas more upon science reasoning, which makes sense if you look at the way our society has progressed, you know. For the most part, certainly in the United States, we don't largely believe in any particular religion. Certainly not any particular. We don't in any in general, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so science kind of became the new belief. The belief became in science. The third civilization, according to him, is this coming together of the two,
mm-hmm.
where we accept the existence of both. And I learned about this idea when I was, I don't know, I must have been an early adolescent. And it kind of struck me. And it started making me more aware of this idea. And I think that what it has culminated in is our ability, our awareness. I think humanity as a whole is becoming more capable to believe in things that were possibly considered unbelievable prior. And I think that we're also becoming aware of more things that we were incapable of recognizing before because of the way that we were blinded by, our ideologies, our acculturation. We're taught to believe certain things, and that, forces us to believe in those things to the exclusion of other ideas. And I think that we're getting to a point where we can accept a greater realm of possibilities than we could in times past. And I think that that's where a lot of the sort of heavier ideas in the book come from. And when I look at religions, it's not because I have a religious agenda or because I am religious per se. I do think of myself as a spiritual person, but not necessarily religious. And so when I was a literature major in my undergraduate and graduate studies, so I often would look at religion because a lot of literature is based upon religion, or at least has allusions to various aspects of different religions. And so I've always looked at religion for meaning, not necessarily for truth. There's a fine line there, but I think one that exists nonetheless. Not to say that you can't find truth from meaning. I think you can. And certainly something that reveals what you might call like a universal truth, I think certainly conveys meaning. But I think that that's what led me to pursue a lot of those topics within the novel. Another idea that I sort of believe in, and I think that this is somewhat from growing up with, I'm half Japanese, so in my family, my father and my grandfather my family going back for a long time is samurai, so they believed in a lot of, the typical samurai ideas. They practice martial arts for generations, honor, and these sorts of things.
Yeah, they live to a similar code to the chivalry and like a knight's code kind of.
Yeah, yeah. Very much. One of the things that they believed in was this idea of I don't know if I have a term for it necessarily, kind of a being in tune with the universe.
Mm-hmm.
I guess. I think that meditation, that's a lot of the idea behind what goes into the practice of meditation. And when I was younger, my father described to me this occurrence where a person could be in tune with just his surroundings to a degree, and he described it as intuition. But it's not necessarily even conscious. It's just that when you're in tune with things, you are protected, in a sense, because now a scientific person might look at a certain occurrence and just say, that was lucky, right? For example, there was a story of that my mother told me where she and my father went fishing, and they were out on a boat, and something happened to where she was very vague on the detail, or perhaps I was younger, it's somewhat unimportant in terms of the story, but a board comes flying out of nowhere. Something happened with the boat, something, and it flipped up. And my father moved out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no real provocation. There was no real warning that it was happening. He just happened to move out of the way inexplicably. And my mother laughs at the story because the board came up and hit her in the face. So She always kind of jokes if he was really in tune with his surroundings, he would have put his arm up or something rather than getting out of the way of the incoming projectile. But I think that it conveys this idea that he was in tune with his surrounding, and it protected him in a way that he wasn't necessarily conscious of, that he was able to get out of the way of this thing. And that idea affected me when I was younger, and I believe in it. This idea that we can be in tune with the universe, and it will lead us down the right path, protect us at times when we need that. And I think that that was the large idea for the main character, who finds himself in these dangerous situations a lot, and yet we sort of get the sense that he's never really in danger. Somehow he always kind of comes out more or less unscathed. But of course, in order to convey that idea, in order to have these horrendous moments that he emerges from, there has to be the horrendous moments, right?
Yeah.
So I think that that's where kind of some of the heavier themes come from.
Well, I mean, right alongside these heavier themes, you know, Our Lady of Guadalupe and the Hawaiian Medicine Man are, there's a lot of pop culture references. I mean,
sure,
a lot of
yeah.
late 90s, early 2000s, you know, you get your Bill Clinton, Britney Spears. I mean, there's even references to older, you know, the Marvin Gaye song kind of plays a part in
sure.
there. I don't know, just kind of comment on putting these just weighty themes next to, I guess,
yeah.
pop culture, some would say meaningless in comparison to...
Sure, okay,
yeah.
I see what you're saying in terms of cultural significance,
yeah.
right? I think that that's the world around us, you
mm-hmm.
know, and I have a hard time separating myself from it. As an academic, I don't like to assume that there's nothing to be learned in these sources of pop culture that pervade our society. There's something alluring about them. I mean, there's a reason that we all know about, you know, any of these various things, right? There's a reason that Marvin Gaye compels most of us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's just a sort of a mirror of the way that our society is. So for me to not be able to include pop culture references throughout my novel, throughout my writing, would be impossible.
Yeah.
It would be like putting on a blinder and ignoring an entire aspect of life. I think that I talked earlier about the way that we are able to accept more ideas. We are aware of multiple cultures. And I mean, a lot of this comes from just the fact of our immersion, our ability to use the internet. You know, we are able to learn about all these things. And as a byproduct, they all are able to get to us as well. And so I think that there are moments of understanding that occur everywhere,
yeah.
you know, and that's the way our life and society is. So I embrace that. And I think that I don't think I could accurately portray the characters in the novel without them having been influenced by these. And particularly the characters in the novel, Charles, the main character, he kind of just floats through life. He hasn't really had any particular, aside from this kind of quest that he finds himself on in the case of the novel,
mm-hmm.
he doesn't really have anything that motivates him to move towards. He doesn't have any goals or aspirations, so to speak. So really, the only things that have influenced him have been those elements of culture that just kind of poke out and for some reason stick with him. And I think that we all have elements of that, so...
Yeah. So you chose to self-publish, right?
Yeah.
So what was the editing process like, and what was the whole publishing process like?
Well, the editing process wasn't terribly difficult for me because of my training.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to teaching, I worked in the Writing Center at the University of Colorado for, I think, 2 years. They didn't like us to label ourselves as editors because we didn't want people to come in to have us edit their papers. The idea was more for us to point out ways to improve their papers. And I think that that's part of why I'm doing what I do now, which is to help teach people how to write. But what it really did was it trained me, and I think grading papers, of course, has trained me to be able to spot errors. And I've been able to do that with my own writing as well. So the editing process hasn't been too difficult. Now, that isn't to say that it's not time-consuming, because especially with a document of this length, things, especially when you write it, you may see something and you skip right past it. Now, the fortunate thing of having a longer document is that when you go back and edit it, you almost forget aspects of it.
It's like you're experiencing it for the first time.
Which is a really strange thing for something that you created, but it aids in the editing process because you're able to see things that you were too close to at the mm-hmm. time that you wrote it to be able to see it.
How long of a period did you spend from when you completed the novel to when you finally self-published it?
I think of the novel itself as my baby because for whatever reason, it took me about nine months to write. Mm-hmm. That was just, and of course there was editing within that process, but after that initial 9 months, the book was complete and there was sort of a series of events that occurred there. When I first finished it, I then started trying to sell it in the traditional method, mm-hmm. okay? So, which was to get an agent and then to have that agent sell the book to a publishing house.
Yeah.
But with the emergence of electronic media, the traditional styles of publishing have become to a degree obsolete or less available. And so in all of the attempts that I made to have an agent see my work, mm-hmm. I got no responses.
Yeah.
And I even got the impression that it wasn't that the book wasn't selected, it was more like it wasn't even looked at.
Yeah.
So which is somewhat discouraging. I mean, it makes you realize as an artist that it seems like there's an element of luck that's required, because I wasn't even to the point where my work would be evaluated on a professional level. It just simply wasn't even noticed.
Yeah.
So eventually I realized that, and it makes sense for the publishing houses too. The reason for this is that with the emergence of electronic publishing, electronic media, the publishing houses have essentially been cut out. And so they have less motivation to want to pick up unknown authors.
Mm-hmm.
They will take celebrities, people who have established themselves as writers, because they know that they can sell a certain number of books. And there's so much competition now because everyone can put out a book. But I realized that that is the way that you basically become a known author at this time, is to put a work out there. And so I had also met with Douglas Preston, who he's a New York Times bestselling author. I happen to know him from growing up in Santa Fe. And I met with him one Christmas Eve, I guess it was 2 years ago or something like that. And he told me, just quite frankly, he said, the best advice that I can give to any new author is to keep writing, to finish that first work and move past it. Don't get caught up in it, don't dwell on it, because he said that that's just not the way that the industry works. You have to experience it before you can really be noticed within it. And so I took that to heart and I said, okay, I can see that it wouldn't be beneficial to just get caught up on this work and to move on and start with other projects. And it was actually, and I did say to him at that time, well, with the emergence of electronic media, what do you think about, I said, I like that idea, and I think I will take that advice and move on to my next project. But because of this opportunity, what do you think about just putting the book out there? And he said, yeah, I think you should do that. You know, that's probably a good idea. That way you at least have the knowledge that you've put your work out there, and then you can move past it.
Mm-hmm.
And strangely, this desire to move beyond it sort of ended up being the impetus to have it produced and put it out there. It was the beginning of last summer. No, it was the beginning of this summer, sorry, that I started to write my next novel.
Mm-hmm.
and I had a lot of momentum. Because, you know, the creative process, I'm sure you've experienced this, you're a writer. I'm sure you experienced that the more that you start creating, the more these ideas start to occur. And so I realized that the writing was coming really nicely, and I had I was a good number of pages into the new novel, and I realized I was somewhat being held back by this book on the back burner.
Yeah.
And so I made the decision. I said, I'm going to spend this summer and really clean it up, get it edited, publish it myself. And that process has been difficult, to say the least, because I'm not a marketing is not my field.
Yeah. I mean, that's especially interesting that you wanted to move past the the book. I mean, because the plot of itself is about grief and kind of moving past it.
That's
so
true.
So it's interesting that you kind of, you know, you wanted to move past this book so you could start working on your next one. And the fact that it's unpublished and it's just sitting here kind of in the back of your mind. I mean, I don't know. That sounds, I've never heard the decision to self-publish be said like that, you know, being the reason, because that, you know, when it's said like that, that makes much more sense, you know, because it's true, you know, you want to move past something.
It makes sense as well that certainly the book is fictional, and it's not based on my life, of course, but naturally there are going to be elements of myself that occur within the book. Mm-hmm. And I like that you pointed that out, because it shows that an element of the book has worked the other way and had an effect on me to create the same sort of motivation.
How much of yourself is in the book?
Well,
can I just assume you're Mickey?
That I'm Mickey?
Yeah.
Wow, that's an interesting assumption. Actually, if anyone were to, I'm sure that to some degree, elements of myself appear as Mickey and Charles.
Yeah.
People that know my personal life, I think, have more made the assumption that my brother is Mickey.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of occupy, now see, I think that I occupy elements of both.
Yeah.
I think that both kind of come from, you know, it's interesting because on the one sense, one of the things that I talk about in the book that comes from the Hawaiian practice of, it's called Ho'oponopono.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with this idea of levels of the self and bringing these levels of self into union with one another. A more westernized and more approachable way of thinking of it is sort of the id, the ego, and the superego.
Yeah.
So then by that reckoning, Mickey more represents the id, because he's always kind of guttural and motivated by base desires, instinctual. Whereas Charles is kind of he's not quite led by his instinctual desires as much as his brother. So I guess you might call him the ego in that analogy.
And then Leia would be the superego?
I don't know if I want to go that far. Yeah. She would like to be. Yeah. She would like to be. But I think we find ourselves at odds with her thinking frequently. Yeah. I know I did.
Yeah. No, definitely reading through. Yeah, she's a little rigid.
Yeah, now. Yeah. But I think that she would describe herself as such. And so I think that because of that, you can assume that elements from myself exist in all the characters, as they are all essentially, in a manner of speaking, the same person. To some degree, they all occupy the same space. And so while they are separate individuals, they culminate to create a single idea or entity. And I think that I could say that in a sense, there are elements of my fractured self all over the place. Now, many of the stories, I don't know to what degree you're supposed to say this. I guess as a self-published, you can say whatever you want. But you always see the caveat that any coincidences, any resemblances, any likenesses to people, real, fictional, is purely coincidental. Which is, of course, ridiculous.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, yeah. Everyone that has these ideas, they came from somewhere. And admittedly, many of the ideas and many of the stories that occur in the in the novel come from my own adolescence. It's particularly strong in the opening section, which occurs in New Mexico, right around where I grew up, and a lot of these sort of archetypical high school personas that we see. I had people in mind when I created those, you know. So in that sense, a lot of the ideas came from my own upbringing. I've yet to have anybody say, was that supposed to be this individual? And, you know, of course, I'm not going to
tell him.
Yeah, not going to own who was my own personal motivation. And, of course, they're all different. I mean, it is fiction. Nothing comes directly out of my life. But
I'm glad you touched on archetypes. I really think that each character is kind of presented as an archetype in sort of a flat manner. And then over the course, regardless of when they're presented, I think they show their hidden depths and how they subvert the archetypes. And was that a conscious effort on your part?
To some degree it was, yeah. I think that I've always been fascinated with Carl Jung, and archetypes were a big... he was very interested in archetypes. And I think that I've found this idea fascinating, particularly in the way that universally I think that we are beginning to break down archetypes in some method. And this is what I mean by when I talk about the idea of our expanding awareness, where we have these ideas that are set in place. We've accepted elements of culture, which according to Jung, comes from archetypes. We have symbols that we have been taught to understand in a certain way, and we expect them to react in a certain way within the world, and everything, to some degree, reacts in this way. But what I find fascinating, and I like that you identify the characters as somewhat deconstructing these archetypes to a degree, is the way that socially, I think that we are beginning to do that. We're beginning to break down these ideas and see where they go when they're not limited to the confines of the archetype that they find themselves within.
Yeah.
So I certainly agree that archetypes were on my mind as I developed the characters, but I also acknowledge and agree with the idea that they sort of begin to break from these archetypes. And that sort of is the, I guess you could look at Charles's path, his journey, as the culmination of that idea that, you know, he begins sort of more fitting these particular molds, and then the more that Mickey and Leah act upon him, and Lupe and Huna, that it ends up making him sort of occupy these more liminal spaces between these set defined archetypes, which I think is an area that we more and more find ourselves in.
Yeah.
So.
All right, just shifting over to point of view. So you decided to go with the third person omniscient, and I think it's appropriate given the subject matter. Just talk about your decision going into that.
Well,
you know, why is it important that we not just hear Charles' thoughts, but Leia's or another character's?
Sure, as well as the narrator.
Yeah.
Well, I think that because for Charles, I very much like writing from the first person. I think that it's personally, I like that point of view because it allows us to really step into that individual.
Yeah.
But I felt with Charles, we needed to approach him from a more universal way because there are a lot of contributing influences that act upon him that he is not aware of, or if he is, it is only on an unconscious level. And so in order to demonstrate those forces acting upon him and the ideas that culminate in his actions, in his behavior, I felt that we needed to see it from a step back. We needed to take a step back and see all the elements that acted upon him.
Yeah. Have you written often in the third person? Or do you mostly just write in the first person in your other stories?
Wow, that's a good question. The majority of my other stories, I have a novel that I'm working on, which is in being written in first person. And I'm struggling with it because I come up against that barrier mm-hmm. of the first person limited yeah. awareness, you know, where I need to convey an idea. And so, and I'm thinking to a number of my short stories, which I think are largely first person. There's something enticing to me about that limited awareness.
Yeah.
We don't get everything. But of course, in the case of Charles, there was too much going on beyond his scope that I felt like I needed to communicate in order to make sense of his life,
yeah.
to make sense of what was happening to him and around him. And then, of course, there's the question of whether or not some of the things happening to him are simply manifestations of himself, if they're illusions, if they're hallucinations that he's having. And there's never a really definitive answer given to that question. So because of that, it couldn't come simply from the point of view of Charles. It had to come from other angles, and it led to that possibility. It led to an openness, which is something that I enjoy in works that I read, openness to interpretation. And I think that that does exist with the character of Charles.
Yeah.
I think that the third person omniscient just lent itself to that.
Okay. So the book is pretty expansive. You go from Albuquerque to Colorado to Mexico
mm-hmm.
to Montana, then Alaska.
Right.
And
Hawaii.
And Hawaii sometimes.
The Hawaii yeah. question is interesting. It's one of those yeah. ideas. Whether or not he goes to Hawaii is for the reader to decide.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess I'm asking why go to all these different places? What brought you as a writer to take the story to those places? And on top of that, I mean, especially Seven Falls, because I mean, Seven Falls is the name of the book.
Right.
Seven Falls is where we keep returning to in this sort right. of quasi-death area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
an altered
yeah.
state
yeah.
of some sort. Yeah. 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 Well, I think that when you depict the plot in that way, Albuquerque to Colorado to Mexico to Montana, Alaska, Hawaii popping in here and there through some inexplicable relationship, it maps like, I mean, it looks like a journey.
Yeah.
It's like a map.
Yeah.
There's a linear path to be followed. And I think that in a very literal sense, it maps Charles's journey in yeah. that way. The thing about it is that Charles is on a journey, but he's not aware of it as such. I don't know that he could necessarily identify himself as being on a journey. I think that it's an aspect that many of us undergo in our own lives, where we are on a path, but we may not necessarily recognize what that path is. This goes back to that idea I was speaking about before of sort of being in tune with the universe and reacting in ways that are unbeknownst to ourselves. He is on a path, but he does nothing to directly put himself on that path or to maintain it.
Yeah.
And yet he's on this path that he can't control. And I think that the physical movement sort of secures that idea of a journey. And for me, for some reason in my own life and in many of the characters that I know and love, I'm able to understand them as moving along a path when they are literally moving,
mm-hmm.
so that it's not just a figurative development that it's occurring, although, of course, that does occur.
Yeah.
There is a actual passage from one area to the next, and I think that his movement and the places he finds himself develop, demonstrate those changes. I think that actually, in that way, there are a couple ways that I sort of point to changes that have occurred for him. His physical location is one. You may have noticed that his name changes frequently. that's another kind of look at the...
Yeah, as he grows.
Mm-hmm. And also just at the way that different people understand him and relate to him. And I think that with each relationship that he has, he becomes more aware of himself.
Yeah.
Until, of course, he finds himself in his culminating location.
Why Seven Falls? What was the significance to you in setting... because
could have been anywhere.
Yeah, it could have been anywhere. Yeah. The dreamlike sequences. Yeah.
Right.
So why Seven Falls?
Well, that certainly comes from my own life.
Yeah.
Because when I think of paradise, I think of Hawaii.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, it's cliche almost even to say. Who doesn't? But that's the power of the place. That's how beautiful it is. That's mm-hmm. how pristine and amazing it is. I went there when I was... I had the fortune to visit when I was younger. I'm going to say I think I was like middle school age. And one of the places we went to was Seven Falls, and it just struck me with its beauty. I mean, yeah. It just felt like I remember thinking I've died and gone to heaven, you know. And so when I imagine a place of pure bliss, that's what I imagine.
Yeah.
Now, it also struck me because of the name, because you of course, in the literal sense, it's called Seven Falls because it's a mountain range dotted by a series of waterfalls.
Yeah.
Seven Falls. But being a lit major, I always read into everything.
Yeah.
And the idea of Seven Falls itself, the idea of Seven Falls, of falling down, sort of depicts this idea of a journey with a number of obstacles, a number of barriers that need to be overcome. And so the name struck me then. And when he first went on his, I don't even know what we want to call it. When he first finds himself in Seven Falls, I was in my, to myself, like you said, it could have been anywhere.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking, where is he going to go to demonstrate this idea? And for me, that's where he went. Yeah.
Okay. How did you decide on the ending? How did you come down?
The ending changed for me as I was progressing through the writing process.
Mm-hmm.
I always knew that he was going to sort of come to this point of understanding where these aspects of himself were going to sort of come into congruence with one another.
Mm-hmm.
That was always on the horizon. So that element of the ending had always been present. As I was moving through, it's the thing that made me notice it, actually, was that I was living with a woman, and I realized that our relationship was not going to succeed.
Yeah.
And for some reason, that moment allowed me to understand that the character of Charles, I was putting him in a place that I felt he was supposed to be, and I realized that it wasn't the genuine story. In a sense, I often talk to my students about the way that the art at some point takes over.
Mm-hmm.
And the characters, in order to be genuine to themselves, have to act as themselves, not as I want them to, not as I want them to. They don't.
Yeah, the plot serves the characters, not the other way around.
Right.
Yeah.
Correct. So when that happened in my life, I was sort of facing this breakup. I realized that Charles, in some way, I was fitting into a mold, and that I was making him into something that I wanted him to become, but that on some level I knew he couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
That if he were to, it would be inauthentic to his character. And so for him to reach the culminating point of his journey, I had to let him do that. I had to let that happen. And when I realized that, I was able to, I understood at that point how the book had to end.
Yeah.
It wasn't so much a choice on my part. It was more of just an eventual outcome. So in a sense, I didn't always know how the book was going to end, but as soon as I knew that the way it was going to end, it couldn't end any other way.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Do you want to talk a little bit about your next project that you're working on? That stage where you want to talk about plot.
My larger work, I'm not at that point yet where I want to talk about it. But the next, another project that I'm sort of working on is now that I'm realizing the availability of the self-publishing, mm-hmm. I'm thinking to take a number of my short stories and put them into a, what's it called?
Anthology?
I guess an anthology is maybe too expansive. I don't know that I have enough.
A short story collection.
A collection of short stories, right. Yeah. So I intend to take a number of my short stories and compile them in a collection and produce that.
Cool.
Put that out there as well. So I'm hearing that from other authors who have published in the self-publishing realm that there is power in numbers. So once you sort of get momentum by having more out there.
Yeah.
So.
Well, cool. Thank you so much for sitting down with
us. Thank you. Yeah. Appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah. That was Hideki Nakazono talking about his book Seven Falls. I hope you enjoyed the podcast and look here at the Jackalope for any more.
Oh, there will be plenty more to come.
Yeah. Our next interview subject is star San Antonio Spurs power forward Tim Duncan.
I'm okay with this.
Looking forward to that.